Hanukkah and New Year's Eve. I'm not sure. In certain communities, I think New Year's Eve would be a bigger competition. In Baltimore, I think Hanukkah, Shabbos Hanukkah is a bigger competition. But be that as it may, I know many people told me they wouldn't be able to be here. We knew when we were planning this that it would be a little bit of a conflict, but finding 3 weeks where you can do something is never so simple. We had Thanksgiving on the other end, which we had to avoid because I was in Israel. So our theoretical discussion of how many people go away for Thanksgiving versus Hanukkah, and which one would be a better week, to start earlier or to start later, ended up being moot because I went to Eretz Yisrael, which I guess is appropriate for the topic. But be that as it may, those of you who are here, both in Baltimore and actually here tonight, we appreciate your presence, and I think it's been a very important and educational few weeks as we've reviewed much of the literature. As you know, essentially the 3 weeks we have divided, the first week was more of a general background and overview. We did see some of the particular views. It was more of a discussion of the debate about some of the more theoretical issues. The famous Gemara that said there are three O's, the Gimel Shavuos, that prevented, at least according to Satmar Rebbe and others who may have been sympathetic to him initially, which would have militated against the establishment of the State of Israel. Other arguments, which in fact, at least one of which we will see tonight, issues of how could there be some kind of a process where it's really not the Jews themselves who are in charge, but it is the non-Jewish governments who are enabling. I have some more sheets if you need. I'll put some back, maybe. As well as the issue of having a group and a process from a religious perspective, which is so dependent on, obviously, a non-religious group. And as we spoke about 2 weeks ago, we shouldn't kid ourselves. First of all, we don't have to kid ourselves because we look at and we know what's going on in the world today. But especially in the 18th, 19th, and 18th centuries, the secular Zionists weren't just secular. They were rabidly anti-religious, and we can't kid ourselves. Whether it was Herzl declaring himself Mashiach, I'll have to see. Someone might have agreed with him in one way or another tonight. Or others, basically mocking the religious, waiting for Mashiach to come. There's not going to be a Messiah. We have to take our future into our own hands. There's no question that that's how it came about in a more socialist and a revolutionary way, which, as we've seen and we all know, put the religious community in a little bit of an awkward position, whether to embrace or not. So that was more of a theoretical discussion with a lot of those primary sources, which was the first week. Last week we had a lecture which I unofficially entitled Shades of Black, in which we discussed last week a variety of different positions, all of which were among great Torah scholars and leaders and rabbis, none of whom would have identified themselves or would accurately be identified as what we'd call Zionists. They wouldn't want the title and it wouldn't have been an accurate title. Yet we tried to show that even within that camp, which, as I said then, and it's certainly worth repeating, even for those who may not subscribe to it, we should at least be open-minded enough not only to study their works because of the content and the value, but we also have to open our eyes to know that whether we may be happy or not about it, it happens to be and has always been the significant majority, from a numerical perspective, demographically, of the Orthodox community. That's a fact. It's been that way since the 1900s, and it's still true today. Maybe one day it'll change, but that is the reality. So given that fact, it's certainly worth knowing and being an educated consumer, so to speak, and studying that. And we saw really a range of positions, even though some of the more extreme tendencies get more of the press, if you will. And we started off on the hard right with the Satmar Rebbe and his approach, which essentially saw the State of Israel as basically not only was it not a good thing, it's actually the product of demonic forces, he believed. And there was a mitzvah to defeat and to destroy the State of Israel. And very, very, really, very, very radical. That was on one extreme. That set the bar, so to speak, for us. But we saw that even gradually moving to the center, there was many other positions. Even some who may have agreed with him that there should not have been a State of Israel. But they vehemently disagreed with him that once the State of Israel was established, how can we not support it when you have, not only because it's our homeland, but because it happens to be a place where millions of Jews live? How can you not be supportive of that? It seems pretty commonsensical, but obviously was not accepted by everybody. And moving forward, we even saw people such as the Chazon Ish, who took what we called a hopeful Zionist approach. He was not willing to commit to some of the messianic overtones that he felt were there in the Zionist position, but he hoped that it would be true. He felt, though, that right away, the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, it was too quick to all of a sudden give a stamp of approval and say, ah, we've made it. He said, we have to wait and see, and unfortunately, we all know things haven't unfolded so smoothly. We're still here, we're still fighting, but in the best sense of the word, we're also still fighting Nebuch in the most difficult sense of that word. So that was a more hesitant approach, and even Rav Dessler, the famous Mashkiach from both Gateshead in England and then in Ponovitch, really a father of modern Haredi thought, and again, someone who certainly was not identified with Mizrahi in any way, but he had two letters that he wrote after the war, while he was still in England before coming back to Israel, in which he spoke about the overt miracles that were taking place in the state of Israel, and he even ended memorably with a very charge that how could people be so blind to see this, and that one day, he means one day after they pass away, they will not have acknowledged the miracles that God is doing for us in the state of Israel, they'll have to answer in judgment for that. So again, it wasn't full-blown acceptance. At the same time, we had certainly come a far distance from the Satmar Rebbe, and we concluded with the amazing letter and the background story that we discussed from Rav Elia Meir Bloch that tells the Rosh Yeshiva in Cleveland, who a few short years, less than 10 years after the State of Israel, actually participated jointly with the local Mizrahi B'nai Akiva in the Yom HaUtz celebration in Cleveland. And needless to say, he got criticized for it. So we have the publication of his letter, which he wrote a week later, in which he defended his position. And he explained there, he wrote, I'm not from Mizrahi, I don't know what he was referring to, but he says, right now, in Cleveland, we're having even more debates with the Mizrahi than we ever had. But it doesn't mean at the same time that A, we can't come together for things that we agree on, and B, it doesn't mean that there aren't positions that I agree with in the Mizrahi camp. And therefore, especially since they gave him an opportunity to speak, he was more than happy to participate in it. Now, as it so happens, those who know, and there were actually some alumni of Pell's who were here last week, so they pointed out to me, as I knew anyway, but that trend in Pell's didn't last long. And in fact, the trend in Pell's is certainly much further. We had the two people who were here last night giving me different theories as to why. One theory was that Rav Elia Meir Bloch thought that there would be more of a cordial mutual respect, and then when he felt that he wasn't being as received, or his group wasn't too received, therefore they moved away. I don't really know. But I do know what Pell's is like now. And I don't think it's been a while in Cleveland since they got together for a Yom HaAtzmaut celebration. And that's unfortunate, but as I say, there were certainly great leaders at that time. So let's assume that that's more or less the summary of what we've done until now. But I would like to conclude our series, and again, conclusion is a very partial term, because as you know, and you can well imagine, we could have given 30 classes on this. It could have been a three-year series. To try to do this in three is really, I feel almost cheating you. I certainly feel like I've been cheating myself. There's so much more, so much that I would like to share with you, so much I've left out. But as you can see from the source sheet, there's 10 pages of sources here. We're going to try to get a lot in, even though we'll still be leaving even more out. And what I'd like to do, if you will, the flip side of last week's class, what I'd like to conclude the series on tonight, is what I would call unofficially, if last week was the shades of black, so this week is the shades of white. Namely, within the camp, within the school of thought, both going back, we'll talk about well before the State of Israel to this very day, within groups of people who are identified as religious Zionists, people who are very much pro before and certainly subsequently the State of Israel, but we shouldn't assume that that's all monolithic viewpoint either. And even though there are many shades, really, fundamentally there are two schools of thought in the religious Zionist world, and it is one in which I would like to explore with you this evening. Before I start, I want to make sure that everyone has some source books. Does everyone have? Because there's some more on the front seats here, and I have a few here left. Maybe you want to put some in the back? And there are some in the back? There are not in the back. Okay. There are still some seats in the front. I want to put these in the back. But everyone should have, like all of my lectures, this is very, very source-focused. So you will lose a lot if you don't have a source book, especially since, for the sake of time, there may be sources that I will only summarize outside, but this way you'll have the sources for the ability to look at yourself at your leisure. Let's start with a personality that should be familiar to us, if it wasn't already, but it should be from 2 weeks ago. We mentioned 2 weeks ago that one of the earliest religious writers in favor of a re-emigration to then what was known as Eretz Israel or Palestine was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer lived in the 1800s. He died in 1874. And among his writings, perhaps his most well-known, was a sefer that he called Drishat Zion, Searching for Zion. And really, he had many other writings that had been collected, or were collected in 1947 in a book called Hakatavim HaTzionim, Shel Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Von and Klausner edited this and put together this collection. And I have for you a few sources here on the top of the page to give you a sense of specifically where I'm going. Because essentially, the real issue which will divide, if you will, what I call the shades of white, divide the different schools of thought, which we are focusing on tonight, is the following issue. To what extent should one view a return to Eretz Yisrael, the state of Israel, its establishment, many of its great military victories, emigration from all four corners of the world, Ethiopia, Russia, North America, to Eretz Yisrael, to what extent should we see this, or should we believe and view this, as part of a messianic process, part of a geula, part of a process which we hope in the near future will soon culminate in Mashiach, as an individual, human Mashiach, rebuilding of a third base Hamikdash, and all of the great eschatological and messianic dreams that our prophets spoke about for centuries, and that we all daven for three times a day. To what extent is this return to the homeland after 2,000 years pregnant with these messianic overtones? Should that be a driving engine, or should it be a result now that we look even retrospectively? Or can we be just as supportive, but really, frankly, have nothing to do with messianism? We'll keep that we believe in it, but we'll put it in the night table, so to speak. There are many, many pragmatic reasons, positive reasons. When I say pragmatic, I don't just mean because it could be, it's cheaper to live in Israel, frankly, right now than it is in America. It's easier to be of less means in Israel. I know people, it's an unbelievable thing. We never would have thought such a thing. There are people making Aliyah now because they have no money. It's easier to live there. The social services, the cost of housing, the cost of education, things are easier to live there. That's not what I mean, of course. I mean that there are practical reasons, especially when the world at large, in certain periods of history, even to a certain extent now, is so hostile for Jews to live in. This is a safe harbor, a homeland, our own defenses. But of course, it's even religious. We have to get to live in Eretz Yisrael. There's a holiness, a sanctity to the land, special mitzvot that can only be done then. Who would be against wanting to live in Israel? Of course, we should all want to live in Israel. And of course, it's a wonderful thing that Jews have control of the land of Israel in the state, in the form of the official state of Israel. But that has nothing to do with Mashiach. I hope Mashiach comes, but that's not our focus. Our focus is living in Israel, living a nice Jewish life, instead of living a nice Jewish life in Teaneck, or in Baltimore, or formerly in Krakow, or in Germany. Now we want to live in Israel, it's even better. Two very, very different approaches. So I want to start, and essentially I want to divide up the whole lecture into those two parts. And I want to start with the Messianic school of thought. We'll go through literally into this very day. We'll trace it from the 19th century to now the 21st century. And then we'll start over again, but look at it from the opposite and sometimes very conflicting perspective of a more pragmatic approach. So the father, really, of this whole process, and particularly one who was very focused on the messianic issue, the geula, the redemptive value of returning to Israel, was Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. So if you look on the top right-hand side, one of the things he says, again, I'm only going to paraphrase parts of it. I apologize if some of these things are difficult to read. You have to understand, they were written in the 19th century. I have some of these things, some of the things I didn't include on the source sheet is because in the Xeroxes they came out completely illegible because literally the pages were falling apart as they were being Xeroxed. Some of these things are very, very old. So the modern typeset and the fonts, which we get so used to, unfortunately did not exist for this literature. But I will read parts of it and I will translate and paraphrase other parts outside. If you look on the top right-hand side where I have it underlined, he makes one of the principal focuses with points, which is a real focus of him and others of his ilk. What he refers to, it's a Kabbalistic notion, it's actually from an Aramaic terminology, Al-Ide Isarusa Milatata, Yabo Isarusa Mila'ela. Through the work we'll do down below, that will inspire, so to speak, divine intervention. Now that is not only a Kabbalistic terminology, it is, in this case, very much a messianic notion. Namely, one of the major issues to confront for this school of thought who believes we should return to Israel and drain the swamps and make, the mountainside should blossom and we should have a state of Israel and that will somehow be part of the messianic process, is that we often tend to think of Mashiach and him coming, etc., as being a very, very dramatic, miraculous, supernatural process. Says the Jewish culture, not so. Maybe there will be miracles that will happen, but we don't just sit back and wait for Mashiach to come passively. If we are activists and we do certain things, we can set a context, we can set the wheels in motion so that Mashiach will come. And he even reiterates this many times in his thought, and this is again one, so to speak, succinct way. The next two sources I have for you, I'll only read the one underneath, but it's really paralleled in the one to the left, are making essentially the same second point, which is an important one to know in this school of thought. Namely, that I think there's a certain assumption which he was confronting, it certainly existed in his day, he just felt it was incorrect, and that is that not only will Mashiach be supernatural, it'll also be instantaneous. You know, that's the notion. We have this idea of I believe it's a true fact, which is incredible in terms of an act of faith, that the Chafetz Chaim had a suitcase packed by his bed, because any day Mashiach could come, and he wanted to be ready. They certainly say this about other gedolim. So that notion, so on the one hand, it's a wonderful story in terms of an act of faith, but it's also making a certain assumption, right? Nothing is going on yesterday, but Mashiach could be here tomorrow. I think many people feel the way. All of a sudden, you know, we're going to hear, we don't exactly know what's going to happen. We'll hear a big chauffeur. We'll go out on the street. We'll see what's going on. Did you know? Get on the wings of eagles, figuratively. We're going to Israel. So says of Kalisher, it's a whole mistake. Not only is it not going to be a supernatural process, at least not initially, it's also not something that's going to happen like the snap of a finger. It's not just going to be an all or nothing. We're going to go from one day nothing to all of a sudden having Mashiach. But rather, it will be a gradual process. And he has very harsh words. As we've seen, this is often at times emotional debate. He has harsh words for people who view things differently. So just to read you the source right underneath, page 258 of this book, it says, there'll be those who will tell you, ki pit'om mishamayim yushlach Mashiach. People will think that out of nowhere, spontaneously, instantaneously, Mashiach will be sent. Miyad gichali michate arosham. You should immediately pour hot coals on their head. Is an emotional way of saying, right, you're wrong. Not true. Not only that, you're kofer b'nevuah. You're denying nevuah. He creates from Yecheskel or other neviim, or one, he wants to indicate that these things are a much more natural process. Chalila lachshov kazos. God forbid to think such a thing. Rather, it's a process. And I didn't put it on the sheet, but one of the primary sources that is quoted by him and others to support this is a medrash. It appears both in the medrash in Tehillim, as well as in a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud and the Talmud Yerushalmi, which describes the coming redemption as similar to the dawn of a new day. And just as the sun rises bit by bit, kima, kima, to use the terminology of Chazal, so too the future geula, according to this tradition, will also be kima, kima, bit by bit. That certainly is a great source that supports his position, which is that this is a process. Just because you don't see Mashiach coming now, doesn't mean that we're not part of a process which will lead to it. And the argument against him, which is that, oh, it'll be a supernatural thing, and it'll just happen instantaneously, so he is arguing very much strenuously against that. One final notion to quote from him before we move on a little bit in history, is we mentioned that the first week, one of the big textual, and therefore very important source, oppositions to the whole focus of Eretz Yisrael, the Zionist approach, was that Talmudic tract, the idea of Shelo Ya'alu B'chomo, the oath that God swore to the Jewish people that they won't rise up like a wall and return to Israel. And we saw that that was the primary source for the Satmar Rebbe and others who agreed with him, that was prohibiting and very much against that strong and nationalistic return to Israel. Of course, we saw the first week about five or six different arguments against his position, why that Gemara was not a correct source. And just to give you one in the context of what we're seeing, this is the third source at the bottom one I have here from Rav Kalischer, pages 97 and 98, where he quotes this Gemara. I have it underlined, B'shash, Shol Ya'alu, B'chomos, we won't return, and as Rashi says, we won't return with great strength and force, B'chazaka, we won't rebel against the nations. So he says that you have to understand that has nothing to do with what we're doing, well, that has nothing to do with what we're doing now. He says what we're doing now is not rebelling or, so to speak, taking it back. We're preparing the land for the time where the final finality will happen. We're not supposed to, so to speak, try to force the end to be doka es hakeitz. Because we're not in the end, we're just in the beginning. We're just in the beginning. And then he says here, as you turn over from one column to the next, from the right column to the left, V'chiyal al-hadash, kasher amad Nechemya, alav ha-shalom. Right, when Nechemya came back to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash, which was after the Shavuos, did somehow Nechemya violate the Shavuos? The answer is, of course not. Why? Because how come Nechemya went back? Because Koresh, the Babylonian king, who happened to have been from a descendant of Esther, and the progeny of Esther and Ahasuerus, so there was, we had Yichus in the castle, so he gave permission to the Jewish people to return. So just like Nehemiah is going back with permission and rebuilding the land, and look what happened, it ended up bringing a Beis HaMikdash, so too, with permission of the land, the people, and in fact, at the time, this is before there was a British mandate, he had plans, he had discussions with the sultans, the Turkish sultans. We're going to do things with permission. We're not here to cause trouble, but we're not looking to cause trouble with the non-Jews. We're looking to cause trouble with the Jews. We want to get them out of their laziness and out of their just, you know, morass. You should get up. Let's go to Israel. Let's do things. And hopefully, with permission, one thing will lead to another and it will snowball. And certainly he's very much focused on hopefully the end being a bringing of the Geula. Now the truth is, I say this began in the late 1800s. The truth is, at the time, especially after his passing, it really fizzled. When I say fizzled, I don't just mean in the non-Zionist world. I mean in the Zionist, for lack of a better term, world. This fizzled. It didn't really pan out. And when we get to the second part of the lecture, you'll see some of the examples, but some of the main, very prominent Rabbanim who generally did support the Shivat Zion, the return to Israel, never focused, but they very much were opposed to his messianic and redemptive focus. And the truth is, it was really, kind of speak, lying fallow and dormant, it was on the books, so to speak, his writings were available, but it didn't really pick up steam. Again, I'm not giving you this as a specific historian, but certainly from my perspective, the next significant moment in time where these thoughts gain much more of significant traction and influence, we can jump ahead quite a few years to Rav Kook. Okay, we know there's two Rav Kooks. We're going to get to the second one tonight as well. But the father, the first Rav Kook, Rav Yitzchak Kohen Kook, who eventually became the chief rabbi in Jaffa, and after that in the pre-state Eretz Yisrael, was known as the chief rabbi of Palestine, dying in the mid-1930s. So he is one who, in general, was a very mystic and Kabbalistic thinker. Now, the truth is that what people don't realize, I've alluded to this once or twice when I've quoted him in other contexts in the shul, that I'm actually much more comfortable in his halachic writings. And what people don't realize is, even though he's more famous for his philosophical and mystical writing, he was actually an unbelievable halachist. If we had nothing else from him but his response and his shuvos, he wouldn't be nearly as famous or infamous as he is. Wouldn't be this controversial. But there's enough there, especially if people wouldn't have been distracted by the other stuff. There's enough there that would have made him, if not the Gadol Hador, but a very, very significant Gadol. Very significant. His focus, and certainly what he's known for more as a legacy, is his philosophy in general, his mystical bent, in many, many areas, and obviously most importantly and significantly to our very day, is in a certain sense you could call him the intellectual or spiritual father of the religious Zionist movement. There's no question about it. Now, again, you have to be careful, just to realize the chronology. He didn't even live to see the state. He died pre-state. His son was a prominent personality his son didn't die until the 80s, early 1980s. But we'll get to him. Let's slow for a moment. So the truth is that there's many, many reasons why, for somebody like me, and I would imagine for most people, Rav Kook is a general and as a primary source is very inaccessible. His writing is incredibly difficult to read. Poetic, very difficult Hebrew, Kabbalistic terms. Plus, it's voluminous. You cannot have. All these bookcases could just be over a Kook's farm. There's so much there. Like, you could learn it forever and not feel like you have your arms around it. And it's for that and many reasons that I have usually, personally, shied away from the primary philosophical sources of Rav Kook. Plus, as a general rule, my inclination, I'm not so mystical and I'm not so. I'm more, a little bit more of a rationalist myself, for better or for worse. So I, in general, have others, frankly, appeal to me a little bit more. But the truth is, preparing even this series, I did more of trying to find and look into his primary sources, and reading and trying to understand it as much as possible, probably half more than I ever had previously. And while I can't give you everything, because there's a limit even to what we can do, certainly in one year, but I just want to give you a little bit of a taste from some primary and some secondary sources of, I hope I'm painting an accurate picture of where a Kook plays into this. And what I want to start with is perhaps one of the lesser known things that he published, because it's not one of the famous books or even particular essays that he published, but it's actually, if I'm not mistaken, and again, full disclosure, I'm not the Rav Kook scholar, but one of the first, if not the first, I think it's the first tract and monograph that he ever published on the whole issue of Eretz Yisrael and State of Israel, Zionism, etc., was actually in 1898, and he was not nearly well known at all. He was a young Latvian rabbi, and it was essentially, in the immediate aftermath, it was a response to the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. And he was a very, very excited, very, very happy about that. Now, he was not happy about everything, because obviously it wasn't primarily religious focus, but he was very, very excited about it. And in fact, to show his excitement, he wrote this essay, but the truth is, the essay is essentially a full embracing of what was going on in the Zionist Congress, but also a way of showing the religious approach to it. In fact, even though the essay is called Al HaTzionut, on Zionism, one of the issues, which I don't have here for you in the source, but one of the big thrusts of the essay is how he wanted to, it obviously didn't work as a movement, but he wanted to create a parallel movement, not Zionism, but Jerusalemism. And so to speak, even Zionism was more nationalist and secular, and his was going to be more nationalist and religious. Now, as a movement, I don't think that gained any traction. I don't know all the historical details, but certainly none of us have heard of it. But this is a very, very important text where he lays out some of the more basic foundations. Plus, I have to be honest with you, it's one of the most accessible things I've ever read from him. I guess this is before, maybe before, because he wasn't an Eretz Yisrael yet, he wasn't overtaken with some of his more flowery writing. I'm not sure exactly the reason, but it's one of the first things that he wrote. It's not the first, and it's really somewhat accessible. So let's just read parts of it. This is in the middle of the first page. He writes, basically, we have to realize the following. Again, a recurrent theme that we saw from Rav Kalischer in the late 19th century, in the late, now he, this is in the late, later on. Again, as I say, the late 19th century, before it was late 18th century, excuse me. So he says here, at the, going into the second line, he says, Ein davar b'ikrei ha'emuna, b'lo b'si'ifeha, shi'ania osanu min harayon, shi'tia hatchalas hitna arusenu, me'afar gulasenu, afar shtadusenu b'dar ha'atavar. Because there's nothing in the Jewish tradition which countervenes the notion that it will be our personal actions and involvement which will somehow bring us up from the dust, from the mire and the dirt of our great diaspora golus experience. We shouldn't think that it's, oh, we just have to wait for Mashiach to come and he'll supernaturally swoop it down and deliver us. He says there's nothing in our tradition that contravenes us. On the contrary. I don't know if he's responding specifically in his day, but we'll see. He's responding to the people...
This is not a letter.
Not to Herzl. No. Right, exactly. But we'll see. That, as I say, contemporaries of Rav Kalischer rejected this. So, as I say, we're skipping a little bit of time, but he is very strong in this notion. We have a religious obligation to everything we can. The issue, Shlo Ya'alu B'chomra, people say, oh, we can't rise up to Israel, that's against the Shvua. He says, no, last line of the right-hand column, it's Rishon HaMalchus, again, the same answer, the governments of the world are giving us permission, so there's nothing wrong with it. And then he says, going over to the left-hand column, we have to realize, Hey, Vinu Mizeh, Rabim, he says, there are some people who think, She'ein L'kavot L'tshuas Yisrael, we shouldn't hope out for a spiritual salvation of Israel. We just have to wait for Eliyahu Hanavi and Mashiach and all sorts of supernatural things to take place. He says, it's all a mistake. It's all a mistake. He says, they think we have to be Mavatel Mizat, Kol Hashtad Luseinu, B'shuv Luseinu, L'shiyat Ameinu. He says, they think we just have to wait and just live in poverty and in deprivation and persecution in Europe and Eastern Europe. This is not true. The whole thing is a mistake. There's nothing in our tradition that prevents us from responding and going full force on our own. Now, the truth is that this was in 1898. Rav Kook himself actually emigrates to Eretz Yisrael in 1904, becoming the chief rabbi of Yafo. He actually gets to Israel a few weeks, if I'm not mistaken, before Herzl dies. We mentioned the first week Herzl died at a young age, tragically, and Rav Kook is there. Now, you can imagine somebody like Rav Kook, this is a little bit of an awkward position. He's very supportive of some of the things that Herzl was doing, but of course, he can't be supportive of everything. And it was a very, Lahavdil, I can tell you, even on my level as a rabbi, we're often put in this kind of a position, whether it's with controversial individuals or causes, where you feel sympathetic to part, but not to other parts. And sometimes it'd be easier, sometimes to just hide, but certainly when you're somebody like Rav Kook and the chief rabbi, you don't necessarily have that opportunity. And it's a difficult balance to know, and one thing you know for sure, whichever you do, someone will criticize you. So what Rav Kook chose to do, which was incredibly controversial in his day, and still is to certain extent, he gave a rabbinic eulogy. He gave a hesped for Herzl. Very, very famous eulogy that he did. And he tried to, again, a hesped is not the place to be critical of somebody. Certain things you have to leave for other contexts. But nevertheless, in a philosophical way, he wanted to deal implicitly with the fact that obviously here is somebody who's completely far from religion, is not anti-religious, yet he's done so much that Rav Kook is sympathetic to, and from his perspective, Rav Kook's perspective, sees as religiously significant. So how did he, so to speak, navigate this very complicated notion? So what he did was, the way he solved this ambivalence, was he very much popularized a notion, which again, certainly now is not the time to go into its sources, but there is some, I wouldn't say it's universally accepted at all, but there is a notion in tradition of there actually being two messiahs, two Mashiachs. The one that we always talk about is known as Mashiach ben David, but there is a notion in some sources that prior to that arrival of that Mashiach ben David, there will be someone known as Mashiach ben Yosef. And not only will they be just two people, because it's a big job, so you might as well get two people to do it, but they'll be doing two very different roles and two very different jobs. And that the notion being that the Mashiach ben David will be the one who heralds in this new utopian world order, which Rav Kook certainly subscribed to, very much so. But before him, there will be this Mashiach ben Yosef who will be leading the world and the Jewish people in a much more real-life way. And in fact, it's so real-life, so to speak. It's in gathering of exiles, fighting wars, the famous Gog-Magog war, maybe. But in fact, in that very tradition, Mashiach ben Yosef dies, and almost, so to speak, in that sense, through his death, heralds the next stage in the Messianic process. So that works out perfectly. Herzl died. And in fact, Rav Kook goes on to identify Herzl, of all people, as Mashiach ben Yosef. So you can imagine, this was very controversial. So look, I have you, I want you to know, I tried mightily to access the original source. You know, I like to give you the access, the original sources, both in Baltimore, and I even tried, even in the YU library, with all the books that they have, they could not find this particular essay. I don't know if I'm finding it. I don't know. But I couldn't find the original. But I did quote for you in a very, very important book, a book that's been very helpful to me in some of my research, by Aviezer Ravitsky, who's a professor of philosophy currently in Eretz Yisrael. He wrote a book called Messianism, Zionism, and Jewish Religious Radicalism. It was written in Hebrew originally. It's been translated into English. Very, very important book. Again, it's very academic and scholarly, but really very, very important. So he gives a little bit of a sense of this eulogy. And he writes, on the one hand, that Rav Kook did not hesitate to speak of Herzl and more generally of the Zion's vision in our day in decidedly messianic terms. The Ikvasa de Mashicha, the footsteps of the Messiah, paving the way for the messianic generation and the like. On the other hand, he carefully or strictly, and this is why I say he wasn't critical of Herzl explicitly, but he's limiting and restricting his praise of him to the use of material messianism, the sort of associated with the Messiah ben Joseph, Mashiach ben Joseph, and therefore with crisis and reversal. Quote, therefore, the Zionist leader fell victim to trouble and suffering. In short, this imagery does not refer to the ultimate end, but to a path full of setback that leads to it. The quest for physical strength and the general firmness of national life and the preparation of Mashiach ben Yosef, while the forces making for spirituality are those that prepare the way for Mashiach ben David. In other words, Rav Kook has this new theology that he has developed. But there can be dual tracks. Herzl and those secularists following him are paving the material, physical success and preparation of the land. That's the Mashiach ben Yosef tract. Very, very important. But of course, it's only part of the story. And those of us, he's obviously referring to himself and his followers, who are doing this from a religious perspective and trying to infuse the land with religiosity, are actually contributing the higher level, but of course it needs the first level first, that will ultimately herald the ultimate and ideal utopian vision of Mashiach ben David. Now, one of the, I would say, perhaps most controversial things that Rav Kook's theology develops, which is already hinted at in one specific way by this aspect of Herzl, is how Rav Kook deals with the non-religious. If you had to ask me, with all the research I've done, what is the single most controversial part of Rav Kook's theology, I would say more than looking at it as the Sfat of the Gula and things like that, it's a very enthusiastic embrace of the non-religious, as I say, especially since many of them were not just non-religious, but virulently anti-religious. Now, you have to understand, from Rav Kook's perspective, this is a great challenge. Here you are, again, Rav Kook was Mamash Atzad. He worked tilling all day. I mean, he was like a holy man from another world. And you're religious, and you're a chassid, and you believe that this has great spiritual meaning. And then you look out, and who are the ones in abundance running to Israel? People who reject everything you believe in. And yet you're saying that everything that they're doing is such a wonderful religious thing. It doesn't work the way we would have usually expected things to work. And Rav Kook is aware of that. But he understands it in such a holistic Well, again, I don't want to get too philosophical on you, but many people have written of the Hegelian influences on Rav Kook. Hegel believed in an evolution of history and processes and thesis and antithesis and synthesis. There's a lot, as I say, to talk about. The scholarship of Rav Kook is even more voluminous than his own writings. But the bottom line is, he develops a philosophy and a theory which understands not only the whole evolution of the state of the return to Eretz Yisrael, but specifically the role of the non-religious that they are playing. And essentially, he basically believes that they are unwitting agents of Hashem. They may not realize it, but they are in fact divine agents. One of the quotes, I couldn't remember the exact Yiddish, but if a monk reminded me of this morning after davening, they said to him, "How can you support the Chilonim? They don't lay tefillin on their arms." You know, so he says, "I know, but they use their arms to build bricks." But he elevated in significance what they were doing to a point. Not that he was excusing, or Kook would be farthest from it, what they weren't doing, but it elevated it to such a point that it gave it significant, religious significance that didn't just allow him to respect. I don't think respect even does justice to the word. A love almost, there's almost no way to put into words the way he enveloped and, so to speak, accepted and elevated really what they are doing. I have for you here in Hebrew one of the quotes from one of his primary books, the Orot HaKodesh, where he seems to hint at something like that. But perhaps to be more clear, let's read from, again, a primary source which I could not get a hold of, but Travisky quotes in his book and translates. And he writes there, bottom of the page, "The brazen ones of his generations who are wicked on principle." Again, he knows who they are. These are people who just happen to not be from. Many of these people were brought up and from homes and rejected. They know what they're rejecting and they do it with great enthusiasm. Nevertheless, they're brazen in principle. They commit crimes out of spite. That's lahakis. And not out of pleasure, their noses are in the air, and yet there are the lights of Tohu, which if you didn't know better, you would think is bad. But it explains to you in Lurianic Kabbalah, of which I know nothing. Lurianic Kabbalah is actually a very high, important thing. And in fact, he develops this notion, what he calls the Shiras HaKelim, namely, again, he's very Kabbalistic in general, mystical, that the spirituality, the light that was embodied in these people was actually so great that it actually has shears, aklipos, I mean, all the Kabbalistic terms he throws in here, and basically their holiness is too much to be contained in a more typical religious lifestyle. It's almost like, you know, you shoot have a shot of energy, a dose of energy, right? What will it do? It blows the system, the computer freezes, right? The computer goes fritz. There's so much spirituality, there's so much holiness here, that, like, it couldn't be contained in a normal, you know, wake up, go to shul, put on tefillin lifestyle. Now, this is a highly, highly original and creative way of looking at people who are Machal Shabbos, Ofer Tarfis, and say we hate your guts to the from people, which is essentially what was going on in the day. We have to be honest what was going on. Yet, this is essentially over and over the position and the philosophy that Rav Kook adopts. Now, you can well imagine, if you'll turn over the page, that this does not endear him to the more traditionalist members of the Torah community, what is known as the Old Yishuv. And I don't have time to get into it in detail, but I just want to mention to you, and I gave you not only a primary text, but also an abridged translation, the Gerer Rebbe, the Imre Emet, or Avraham Mordechai Gerer, who was at the time the head of not only the biggest Hasidus in Europe, but also therefore the official head, titular head of the Aguda, and someone who's generally, sort of from a Hasidic perspective, relatively sympathetic with the Shivat Zion movement, he actually came intentionally to Eretz Yisrael for a specific trip in 21, in April of 1921, when the Rav Kook bashing, if you will, and the controversies of Rav Kook's philosophy had reached its apex. People wanted to put him in Chayrim, they did put him in Chayrim, they blew a shofar when they put him in Chayrim, they banned his book Orot. A lot of stuff was going on. And the Ger Rebbe came to mediate. And he actually spent a month in Israel, meeting with both sides. He had measured success, certainly not as much success as the Rav Kook camp was hoping for, but Lamaisa, he had measured success. On his return home to Europe, he writes a letter, which in fact he dates, and he writes, Batsfina, I'm writing it on the boat. He sends it back to his family in Europe, where he summarizes his trip. And again, I don't have time to read it for you now, but just to give you two set things. Number one is, to me, this is the model which halavai would we reproduce in our own age for how you have civil disagreement. If you'll read this, you'll see two incredible things. He goes on and on to compliment Rav Kook. He's a gaon and a tzaddik. He actually refers to him as an ish eshkolot, which in Hasidic terminology is the highest compliment you can give. It basically means he's someone, Ish Asher HaKol Bo. He has everything. He has mysticism, he has halacha, he has spirituality, he has philosophy, he has this. It's someone who's mamish, the master of everything. And Imre Emes, who's the Gadol HaDor for the Hasidim, he says, that's who Rav Kook is. Tremendous respect for him. In fact, he was so respectful that while he was in Yerushalayim, there were posters flying up criticizing the Ger Rebbe. In fact, the Ger Rebbe's name was Avraham Mordechai. Rav Kook's name was Avraham Yitzchak. So they had big posters. Avraham equals Avraham. Oh, yeah, you can imagine. I mean, the Ger Rebbe was more than insulated. If you've ever seen any of the Ger Rebbe's, there are big people who walk near them. The Gerers happen to be very, very big. That's why I'm related on my mother's side. Because Gerers are big and brawny. So the Ger Rebbe was fine. Don't worry about him. But very supportive of Rav Kook as an individual. And yet, it doesn't mean that he subscribes to everything Rav Kook believes. In fact, he writes here, not only that he loved Rav Kook and was respectful of Rav Kook, but he had one primary disagreement. What was the disagreement? Not in general about the messianic stuff. Nothing, not about that. One primary thing. His embrace of the secular Jews. He says, Rav Kook is metaher the tmeim. Rav Kook is saying about what's impure, it's pure. He says, we have to get things straight. He says, to act civilly with them would be one thing, but the way Rav Kook seems to respond to them, Shalom Aleichem, Malachi Ashareis, he treats them with such elevated significance, he thinks that they're so holy. Ger Rebbe thinks, first of all, in principle it's wrong. And second of all, he thinks practically it's wrong. He says, you're confusing our youth. If they're going to see that you can embrace someone who doesn't wear a yarmulke and just spends the whole day draining a swamp, so why should they sit in yeshiva and learn? Why should they put on a yarmulke? Why should they put on tefillin? It's a confusing message the Ger Rebbe felt. And it was on that particular point, which I think sometimes gets lost, frankly, but it's actually on that point that, at least from the perspective of the others, Rav Kook was most vulnerable. Not in his general messianic outlook, but specifically, again, I'm not saying the Ger Rebbe exactly subscribed to that either, but that was not what was bothering him. What really he thought was going too far, he says there that Rav Kook's Avas Tzion and Avas Yisrael were too far. Now, it actually confirms a story. When I was, in 1993, my second year, my first year, I was in 1992. One of those 2 years, I was learning Yad Yisrael, and since I have a Ger Hasidic background, I, through my parents, made arrangements, I went to Ger in Yerushalayim, in Geula, for Shabbos. I still remember, I asked Rosh Hashiva, should I wear a hat? So he said to me something very sharp. He says, listen, what are you going to put on a black hat? You think you're going to fit in? You're not wearing a fur hat. Once you're not going to fit in, you might as well be who you are. Yes. So I went in my white shirt and my big knit kippah and my blue pants, and I stuck out. But not that much more than if I would have. No black hats in Gare either. That's just fur, a Shabbos. But it's okay, because since I'm a relative, they put me right in. Anyway, it was a very, very nice Shabbos. So my host, who's a very, from the leadership of the community there, we were schmoozing a Friday afternoon. And I don't think, if this had happened a few years earlier, I would guess that I was doing to be a troublemaker. But I was a little bit more mature then. And I think I was just sincerely talking with him about things. Anyway, what are you learning? Hezri Yeshiva, back. So I asked him something about Rav Kook, and I knew this before I knew any of this stuff. And I remember him telling me, Rav Kook was an Ish Eshkolot. Whoa, that's okay. And I didn't know what that meant, because that's the highest compliment I could give. So I was like, well, you know, right, you're playing with half money at that point. So I said, well, then, you know, I kind of, you know, you don't look like what we call a kooknik. You know, so what happened? So he said, too much Avas Yisrael. That's a quote. Too much Avas, you know, usually we don't think of Avas Yisrael loving Jesus as being a bad thing. And he doesn't really either. But we have a notion, right? We have a saying, too much of a good thing. That's exactly their perspective. And I didn't know this, but he was getting that. So it was one thing you know for sure. They don't hide this letter from Ger. Now, this is not a letter that they deny. This is a known letter. No one denies this letter. But certainly in Ger, they embrace it. Kook was a tzaddik, Kook was wonderful. He had one problem. Too much Avas Yisrael. There has to be limits on certain things. We're supposed to hate Rishayim. We're supposed to, you know, disagree with them. We're supposed to condemn them. We're not supposed to just love them. You know, a parent loves a child on any reservation. But chutz mizeh, we have to have limits. We have to have standards. So that is just, as I say, an important thing to keep in mind. I have for you here from Ravitsky also a quote from Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, who was older and the more Lithuanian, if you will, non-Hasidic contemporary of Rav Kook's. He's older than him. Also, again, what was the main thing he was critical of Rav Kook for? The embrace of the non-religious. It was a weird thing. They couldn't handle that. That was a very, very big issue. Let me turn for a moment, just to give you a sense of sources. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook was his father's successor in his yeshiva. Whether he's his successor ideologically is a little bit of a point of contention. In Israel today, if you speak to academics or in general people in the the religious Zionist world, there are those who feel that Tzvi Yehuda Kook is fully an embodiment of his father, except for his father lived in a free state, and Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, lived, obviously, when the state was already in existence. And there are those, including this fellow Ravitsky, but he's not the only one, who feel that Rav Tzvi Yehuda may have shifted focus or radicalized, especially after 1967, his father's ideology. Now, the bottom line is, if you ask the average person walking through the streets in Eretz Yisrael, the average 20-year-old yeshiva guy with a knit kippah, they would probably assume that Rav Tzvi Yehuda and his father, it's all one thing. Why do I do what I do? Why do I believe what I believe? Why am I living out in a trailer on an empty hill somewhere? Harav Kook, and they mean the father. Their Rebbeim are all Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. The single most dominant influence in the Zionistic world today, because all the Rashivas are his Talmidim. And he was the Rashiva that was living at a time, perhaps the single most dramatic time in modern Jewish history, in the aftermath of the Six-Day War. And that's, he is essentially the intellectual architect of what they call now Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, this notion of the greater Israel, Gush Emunim, the territories, and all the things that you hear about on the news. And of course we know that we're not getting the full story on the news, but even when we go to Eretz Yisrael and we love them and we support them, we visit them, that entire movement, one way or another, essentially is derived from Tzvi Yehuda, and obviously to some extent for sure from his father. To what extent is certainly debatable. I just wanted to show with you some of the sources that he said. If you turn over the page, because really, again, I had no intention of covering all of this inside with you, at least not in an hour and 15 minutes. But at the end of the day, I like to put these things on the source sheet so that you can have them for yourself and you can take them with you. Just to give you a sense of one thing from, not from him himself, but one of the prominent Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda is someone named Rav Chaim Drukman. You may have heard of Rav Drukman. Rav Drukman is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva called Or Etzion, not to be confused with Gush Etzion. Just two different yeshivas. Or Har Etzion, right? Or Etzion, very different yeshiva, because Rosh Yeshiva is Rav Drukman. He was, like one of the Rosh Yeshivas of Har Etzion, a member of Knesset at one upon a time. I don't think he is anymore. But he is a very prominent, one of the most prominent Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. So he, in 1982, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook died in 1981. In 1982, they published a memorial book called Rabbeinu Zatzal. That was the name of the book. Our master, our teacher, of blessed memory. And Rav Drukman, has a hesped there that he gave for his Rebbe, which they printed here. So just to give you a sense, again, I'm assuming that he is faithful to his Rebbe, and for now we'll assume that there's more or less a progression from the father, Kook, to the son, Rav Kook. Just to give you some of the quotes here, which just to show you how dramatic and how strong a turn we're taking. First of all, he says in the end of the second paragraph, what was the difference between the father and the son? Only one thing, that the son took all of his father's works and divrei harav befoel. He had a state of Israel. He brought the theoretical Rav Kook into halacha lamaisa, as he put it. Medinas Yisrael, hamamashit, al-kol, I can't even read my own Xerox. Hamamashit, I can't even, it's kol ha, what does that say? Right, thank you. I could barely read it. Thank you. In other words, the process which began with the father, which is only theoretical, becomes actualized in the time period of his son, and he's the one who embodies it. Then he writes in the next paragraph, I think that Rav Yehuda, my Rebbe, is the single one in the generation who realized, in the most significant, profound way, second line of that paragraph, in the fundamentally way, that Giloy HaMashichi Shemedinas Yisrael, the messianic revelation which is embodied in the state of Israel. Shiroeth Oro Shel Mashiach, he saw the light of Mashiach coming out and shining forth from the Medinas Yisrael. Other people supported Israel, other people think it's a good thing, but if you look at the next line, the Tzvos says, Omek Emes, to realize the truth in its most profound way, Hagilo HaEloki, the divine revelation, Shebetukufas, is that what it says? Medinas Yisrael, the establishment, yeah, I'm sorry, Kumas, sorry, yes, the establishment of the state of Israel, lahazdahut b'tzura muchletes, im ha'emes, to identify it without any doubt with the truth, shemedinas Yisrael, he, medina elokit, it is a holy, divine state, despite its problems, oz zeshamanu achmipiv, that was his teaching. He was the one who was more dramatic in that. He, in the next paragraph, speaks about how happy his Rebbe was on Yom HaTzimut, how much of a pleasure it was to see that, etc., etc. On the top left-hand column, he speaks about, again, the Geula coming piece by piece, Kima by Kima, we mentioned that before. And then he has a quote from the father, from Rav Kook, which again is quoted very often by Rav Tzvi Yehuda and his Talmidim, Shemedinas Yisrael, he sowed Kizeh Hashem Ba'olam. the base, if you will, it's a metaphor, of course, but the chair of God in the world, one of the closest embodiment to the God in this world, the state of Israel, Medinas Yisrael. He then, in the final two paragraphs, mentions, which again is an obvious extension of this, that because you have that view of the state, so then what takes place? That echoes out, ripple effect, to his view of the army. And he writes there how Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, saw every tank, every gun, every missile, each one was another shliach of Hashem. Each one of them was doing a mitzvah. Again, this average chiloni 18-year-old doesn't know anything from anything about Torah, unfortunately. And he's on a mountaintop somewhere, but he's guarding a settlement, and he's fighting in Lebanon, and he's going into what's about the Gush Katif, wherever. So each one of those is a shluach Hashem, is a holy angel, is a holy messenger of Hashem. Each tank, each gun, each missile, because it's all part of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, in the final paragraph, we come, not necessarily full circle, but we dot the final I, where he mentions his Rebbe's love of the non-religious, of the chilonim, and how his love of everything that was going on in Israel, his avas ha-nefesh, included anshe hagit hashvut, lakol notena, all the stripes, no matter who they were, of the settlement. Sharei, every one of them, they are the ones who are being mekayim with their own bodies, with their guf, the Mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Im kol ha-ke'ei v'hatzar al-choser ha-shleimut, despite the fact that he, of course, was pained by the fact that they weren't exactly ideal in the sense that he would have liked, they weren't religious as he would have liked, nevertheless, in Kolze, he still loved and appreciated everyone who was in Eretz Yisrael. Ahava Rava, the Dafka Mitov Kosa Ahava Ke'ev Esachisaro. It's because he loved what they were doing so much, he was pained by the fact that they weren't as perfect and ideal and religious as he would have liked. More quotes from Ravitsky, which we've seen, similar notions, the state of Israel as the fulfillment of the biblical vision of redemption. The end, in the just the one on page 82 perhaps, is the most extreme. The end is being revealed before our eyes. There can be no doubt or question that would detract from our joy and gratitude to the Redeemer of Israel. The end is here. There's no room for doubt. There's no equivocation. This is Eschalta de Geula. Maybe we're already in the middle. I don't know. We're there. We're coming. No, he has other quotes. There's no turning back. The process has started. Definite, the state of Israel, it's a revelation of God, it's a revelation of Mashiach. I mean, as much hyperbole as you can give, you cannot exaggerate how focused and messianic he views the state of Israel and the dominant influence that he has had on an entire, so to speak, generation. Just to give you a little bit more on this, so to speak, side of the fence, I wouldn't necessarily exactly identify with Yehuda Kook, but you should know that one of my great Rebbeim, Herschel Schechter, so he... not only not embarrassed, he publishes an article in one of his Sfarim, Simulam Abeis of his Sefer Kvetzon, where he writes, he postulates based on his halakha determination, that we are now living in a stage, he writes there explicitly, that the established state of Israel is Eschalta de Geula. Unapologetic, if you looked on the lab, just to give you the lot here, and anyone who wants a full copy of the article, I'm happy to Xerox it for you, I have the Sefer at home. But if you look at the bottom of the page, he writes, Kasher einenu ro'o, says our eyes have seen, everything that's happened in the last 50 years, this is what the Nevi'im had promised and predicted. This will not happen, and once now that we're here, no one's going to uproot us, nothing's going to stop us, no one's going to take us from our land. Etc. Other Makarzi quotes, we should establish, we should determine, we should decide, the establishment of the state of Israel 1948, He has thought of the Geula. And it's true, for those who know him, again, I wouldn't call him exactly identical to Yehuda Kook, not by any stretch per se, although he does have a son-in-law who's learning in Merkaz Harav. But, Rav Schechter, I would say this, from this, and other impressions that I've had of him, you would call him maybe a little bit more moderate than what we saw before, but certainly in the messianic religious Zionist camp. I don't have time to read it for you inside, other than to tell you one notion, to give you one of the sources. If you turn over the page, I quoted for you here the first half, and at the end of the sources, you'll see a second half, a debate that took place on the pages of a journal called Shema. I think the journal still exists. This is from 1974, the journal I got for you. It's right after the Yom Kippur War, and there's a debate, not a debate between Zionists and non-Zionists, it's a debate between two Zionists and Rabbanim. Rabbi Schubert Spiro, a cousin of the Spiros in Baltimore, and it was a rabbi in Cleveland, and he put his money in his mouth, he made Aliyah. In fact, he is the father-in-law of the late Dr. David Applebaum, Hashem Yimkom Damo, who died 2+ years ago in a terrorist attack with his daughter, Nava. So Schubert Spiro was a tremendous Zionist, and he, as I say, he did what he said, he went to Israel himself. He has a huge debate with another religious Zionist named Rabbi Norman Lamb. You've heard of him, okay. Baltimore, you never know. This was before Rabbi Lam was at Yeshiva University. He was just, it was already a prominent rabbi. But they have a major debate. And Rabbi Shubert Spiro takes a very strong, unequivocal, messianic, Zionistic approach. You'll see, again, it's easier for you to read yourself. Very, very firm. But one quote I want to show you, just because it shows you how delicate and dangerous we have to such an approach is, and it'll be a segue to our second part of the shiur, is if you look at paragraph 2. What we messianists, he calls himself that, he's unapologetic, are committed to, is expectations the Zionist gains to date will not be rolled back. They will not be erased. We will remain in our lands. We will have control over Judea and Samaria. We will not be surrendering. The Sa'ata Zagula hypothesis implies that such an ongoing pattern of events, in line with my empirical posture, I must state that should God forbid any of these expectations be falsified, I would have to say, al chait. And he writes, I think, did I include this for you here? Maybe not. He writes that he expects nothing to be, so I don't know, I would call him up with respect. I think he's kind of already still alive. He's not a young man. What do you think about what happened this summer? He holds that if any of these things are rolled back, I was wrong. So, the danger of taking such a messianic approach is, of course, one if it doesn't seem to work out. In other words, if you will, to borrow the analogy, you put all of your money in the pot. You're either going to win big, or you're risking the alternative. Again, parallel, if you will, the fear that many of us have, or continue to have, with the issues that surrounded the Lubavitcher Rebbe. That wasn't about messianism as a process or Israel per se, it was about Mashiach as an individual. So in theory, they could have been right. I didn't know for sure that they were wrong while he was alive. I now know that he was wrong. They were wrong. Rambam says that if somebody dies, that means that they couldn't have been Mashiach. So you know how some of them deal with that. He didn't die. But again, these are otherwise rational, nice, wonderful people. What would bring someone to such extremism? The answer is desperation. Because when you're that committed, when you get out that far on the ledge, you can't turn back. And there's no question that there's a fear that that has happened with this segment of the religious Zionist community. In fact, it was a fear which existed well before this current posture. So if you want, let's turn now, we won't have as much time, but I want to show you the second half of the story. We just got all the way to Gush Katif. Let's go all the way back to the 19th century.
What was Rabbi Lam's...
We'll get to it.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe we won't, but I'll tell you about it.
Right.
He took the other approach. Perhaps the foremost and the first expositor of this approach was none other than the great Netziv of Elazar. Now, until now, we'd say Netziv was, in one perspective, Netziv was, unlike other Gedolim of his era, Netziv was a proponent of the Chivat Zion, the Shivat Zion. He was a proponent of the return to Eretz Yisrael. However, he was very concerned about Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who we started this year with. Because Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer saw everything from the perspective of redemption, of Gula. And in fact, in this letter, which comes, I believe, from 1891, it's reproduced in a book that was published more recently, but the letter is dated 1891, he writes his ambivalence not towards Eretz Yisrael, of course, but sort of Kalischer as an individual, even though he respects him, he calls him a Gaon and a Tzaddik, and his books. He says, the reason I'm not supportive of him individually or the books is because too much is focused on the Geula. As he suggests that he was inspired by the Enlightenment and what was going on, the emancipation was happening to the Jews in Western Europe, and therefore he thought, oh, everything, historical tides are turning. But says to Beitalevi, look, where I am in Russia now, pogroms are getting worse, persecution is getting worse. It's not exactly turning into a messianic utopia for us here in Eastern Europe. He was wrong, and it's dangerous, and then he adds an interesting insight. It's interesting, if you look on the bottom of the right-hand column and over the left, he says, if we speak about Geula, then the nice non-Jewish governments who are now supporting what we're doing, why are they going to want to support us? To get us off their chest, to let us emigrate, or even some of the people who are controlling Israel at the time, okay, well, let us live here. But if they think the reason we're living here is because it's about to usher in our messianic and control of the world, one prime minister, one sultan somewhere is going to go, hey, this isn't a good idea. What if the Jews are right, right? We know the non-Jews have always had a funny way of relating to us and our prophecies, right? Go back to this coming week's partial, these coming partials with Paro, right? On the one hand, he had also the premonitions about Moshe being some leader. So I was wondering, well, if he thought about that, and he obviously, so if he didn't believe in anything of Judaism, so he should have just dismissed it. It was an Irish guy. But apparently, he was worried about it enough that he had to kill every Jewish baby. You know, they're not sure, maybe those Jews are right. And therefore, they always err on the side of persecuting us just to make sure. And that's Jewish history, unfortunately. So the Beis Halevi was worried about that. Right now, they're letting us move to Israel. If we start banging too loud, oh, Mashiach, Gula. I don't want that. My maybe they'll pull back. We have to be very, very careful. We have scholars have noted, although again, I did my best to try to find it, I could not, again, from around 1900 or so, a letter that Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, who we've quoted before, a different letter 2 weeks ago, also where he had an Aguda convention, then writes his support for return to Eretz Yisrael, etc., but just, you know, cool it on the messianism. So already in the earliest parts of this movement, going back again, late 19th, early 20th century, we've seen a major shift. And in fact, Marcel, you asked me, who was he responding to? So I don't know if it's directly or not, and he was a Talmud of Volozhin, a Talmud of Vinitziv, interestingly. But the point is, Rav Kalischer, for all of his bravado, or that's the wrong word, excuse me, but for all of his enthusiasm for the messianic process, and you have the Nesiv and the Meir Simcha of Divinz coming out against you, it's not surprising to me that it didn't gain that much traction. Again, it got picked up later by Rav Kook and became very popular, but the truth is, aside from the Nesiv, perhaps the most well-known protagonist, the one who's antagonist of this messianic view, is actually somebody named Rav Yitzchak Reines. Rabbi Reines is a very important thing, and it's an incredible irony for those who are Mizrahi messianists. Rav Reines founded the Mizrahi. You want to know a date? You need to know one person. Who founded Mizrahi? Rabbi Reines. Rabbi Reines was incredibly adamant, time and time again, anti the messianism. His desire to return to Eretz Yisrael has nothing to do with the Geula, nothing to do with Mashiach. Keep it quiet, put it back in the drawer, sing it in Yigdal, we hope. But that's not what we're doing here. And in fact, in the year 1900, if you turn over your page, there was a Mikhtav Rabbanim, a public letter, an open letter that went out by a number of other Rabbanim. You see at the bottom of column 5, I have the other Rabbanim's names. I don't recognize personally any of them. I'm sure they're great tzaddikim. But the biggest, the most famous of these Rabbanim is the first one listed, Ne'um Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, Bezdin and Rashiva of Lida. Parenthetically, Lida was, they considered perhaps the first modern yeshiva. It was one that not only had Torah, but it also not only had Gemara, sitting like in Cheder all day, but he had, if I'm not mistaken, not only did he have Tanakh and other things as part of the curriculum, but I believe he even introduced secular studies. So he was controversial in every realm, right? Somebody we would like, right? Rabbinus, a wonderful, wonderful, again, a great Talmud Chacham, Rosh Yeshiva, who was known and respected tremendously, but he had a position which was controversial on both ends, so to speak. The more messianists didn't like him because he didn't want to go that far. And those who were, if you will, more staunchly traditionalists didn't like him either. In this public letter, he says a number of incredible things. I just want to read you a little bit of part of it. If you look in the middle of the second paragraph, he writes, this is a letter from 1900. The Chol HaChoshvim, Shiesh, the Hirayon, Hazeh, Eiz Inyan Shel Geula HaAtida, Ubiyas HaMashiach. Anyone who thinks that in this whole process that he's a very big proponent of returning to Israel, etc., that it has anything, even a shmek, just even a little bit to do with Mashiach, it's a humongous mistake. Roim bazeh shiesh bazeh harisal ikr echem ikrei munasenu enim elatoim. Anyone who thinks that somehow this is for Mashiach, and then they'll add, and that's corrupting Mashiach, because as you remember, we mentioned that many people hold Mashiach is going to be a passive thing and miraculous, so how could people say Mashiach is going to come in an activist way, so they say you're corrupting the belief in Mashiach, because the whole thing is a mistake, Ein Ola Toim. Ein Bezeg Gam Kurtav Shel Inyan Me'gula. There's nothing, no even small amount of messianism or redemptive focus in our desire. Kol Ikro Shel Rayon, why, so therefore why we want to all emigrate to Israel, what's this whole Shiva Tzion, Azeh, we want to have a better situation. We're mired in poverty and persecution here. Let's make a new life for ourselves. Instead of being under the thumb of the non-Jews and the Galus, let's go to Israel and make it ourselves. Right? It's like someone who's in a difficult life says, you know, why are you worried? Your boss is persecuting you every day. Go out on your own. Start your own business. That's what Brian says. It's very pragmatic. Again, not pragmatic in a negative way. These are incredibly elevated things to help Jews live a better life, to do it in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But it has nothing to do with Geula, Messianism, Mashiach. The whole thing is a mistake. Again, he mentions even more. We'll have to leave it for now. Without, as I said, I'm not giving you a direct timeline or a history lesson, but perhaps, at least to me, the next and most important, relevant and contemporary for us, of someone who I would suggest embodies this second school of thought, was none other than Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik perhaps gave his first and maybe to this day most well-known talk on Israel and his approach in 1962. I'm sorry, 1956. At a Yom HaAtzmaut celebration in 1956, Rav Soloveitchik delivered a Yiddish lecture, which was entitled Kol Dodi Dofek. It's a title taken from Shir HaShirim, which is the midrashic basis of the speech. My beloved is knocking for me. He discusses many things. It was originally then written up and transcribed in Hebrew, and eventually translated into English. So what you have here is a translation by a professor from Montreal, Lawrence Kaplan, but again, it's a translation of a translation. Now, if anyone has a take with Yiddish, so I would prefer listening to that too. But I don't know if it's accessible, and even the Hebrew is not the Rav's words. The Rav spoke in Yiddish. But we have this English translation. We really could have spent an hour just on this. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do so. But I put for you, I snip it and cut and paste it for you, little bit of paragraphs of each one of the major things he says. In the section of the essay about Israel, his basic premise, which is so dramatic and so beautiful, you see, he writes here on the left-hand side, he begins, there's 8 years after the state of Israel, in the midst of the night of terror, the horrors of Maidanek and Treblinka, etc., night of gas chambers and crematoria, etc., etc., what happened? We thought we were all alone. We wanted Hashem, but where was he? In that very night, our beloved appeared, and God who concealed himself all of a sudden comes to us. And as a result of the knocks on the door, again using the metaphor of Shir HaShirim, wrapped in mourning, the state of Israel was born. And he goes on, using this drush, to explain that the established state of Israel represented God, as it were, knocking to us and to the world six times. He says the state of Israel represents six knocks. In other words, these are six incredibly wonderful messages that God was sending us by allowing for the establishment of the state of Israel. So just look, again, the language is beautiful. I beg of you, take this home. Read it. If you buy the book originally, ask for me, I'll direct the whole essay for you. You have to read this stuff. It's so powerful and so beautiful. The first knock was in the political arena. And one denied from the standpoint of international relations, the establishment of the state of Israel in a political sense was an almost supernatural occurrence. You remember, right? The Cold War. Russia and America come together. He points out it happened through the UN. He suggests that he thinks that this is the only single good thing the UN ever did. Isn't he wrote this in the 50s. Can you imagine what he would say now? That's before Kofi Annan. Right? Can you imagine? Right, but I guess that's true. Once you've said it so strongly, I guess there's nothing more to add. I don't think he would have changed his mind, though, Barry, is what I'm saying. And he writes, unbelievable, he has a beautiful measure. She says, you know, we say in the Megillah, that whatever refers... Before you leave, in the Megillah, we say that when it refers to HaMelech, it's really a symbol, it's a hidden message for God. So he has an allusion there too. He talks about when the head of the UN is banging the gavel and talking. He says it may have been him, but who was speaking through him? It goes, of course, it was God who was doing that. Someone who at the time observed matters with a spiritual eye could have sensed the presence of the true chairman who presided over the discussion, the beloved, meaning Hashem. So just the politics that involved. Now, as a PS for another time, I have it on pretty good authority that Rav Soloveitchik himself was indirectly responsible for about seven of the votes through his relationship with the Archdiocese of Boston, but that will have to be for another time. First, I got to confirm if it's true, but I don't know if it's confirmable. But on good, reliable information, I have some of the smaller Catholic countries who are looking for guidance, and the head of Mizrahi, they came and they asked Soloveitchik, please speak to your friends, the Catholic friends in Boston, who apparently were involved. If that's true, it's an awesome PS footnote to history. If it's not true, it just made for a good story to drop in. But people I know from Boston or close to Soloveitchik at the time have told me this. So there could be, and the story originally goes back probably Walter Wurzberger, who was one of the closest Talmidim of the Rav at that time. So it certainly may very well be true. Second knock, not just political, which was incredibly. The knock came below, which we heard on the battlefield. The small Israeli defense forces defeated the mighty armies of the Arab countries. Hanukkah, Rabin, Yad Ma'atim. An even greater miracle occurred at the time. Unbelievable. He points out that it wasn't just a miracle that we won. It was a miracle that they first attacked us. And we know the state of Israel is much bigger than it would have been had they not attacked us. The partition plan, the original state of Israel, the boundaries were much smaller. It was only because they attacked us and we won, but we got more. Oh, what a miracle, he says. That's the second knock. The third knock is the theological tense. And this may be the strongest one. If you remember last year, we had our first lecture series on Jewish-Christian relations. I mentioned this idea of the Rav. The Rav felt very strongly that one of the powerful messages of the established state of Israel is that it was, without any doubt, the single greatest disproof to Christianity.
which is why the Vatican has had such an ambivalent and difficult time, and only until recently have they even officially recognized the state of Israel. Because the entire premise of Christianity from its founding was that the Jews were the chosen nation. They didn't listen, so God abandoned them and picked. And one of the proofs that they've given, and Rav Chaim writes here, that if you don't know inside the writings of the church fathers and the real philosophy, you can't appreciate how significant this is. But they reiterated time and time again that their own people, that in their own parishes and their own churches, how you see that we're the chosen people and the Jews have been rejected? Look at them, they're living this terrible nomadic existence. The fact that we return to our land, have our own country in Eretz Yisrael, he said that's why they can't. It's a disproof to their whole premise that we've been rejected and forgotten. And this Rav Soloveitchik felt was very, very important. Fourth, the knocking in the hearts of the perplexed and assimilated youths. He speaks about how there was such an estrangement, right, in the time, in the 50s and the 60s, so much estrangement going on with the teenagers and the college-age students from traditional Judaism. He says, but you know what? Because there's a state of Israel, they can't hide from being Jewish. It gives them, first of all, in the positive sense, it gives them identity. As he says, you know, you open up the newspaper, you want to see what happened to Israel. And that itself is something, even if you're far removed from everything else. And second of all, as we know to this very day, right, students in secular campuses, they could be the farthest thing from interested, but to everybody else, right, they're just this one who loves Israel and persecutes Palestinians. And it's a big problem for our students on campus, but it's a big problem for them. But looking at it, so to speak, from on top, Rav Soloveitchik said it's a good thing. It's a good thing. We wish that people wouldn't persecute Israel, obviously. But the fact is, they're forced to confront their Judaism and their relationship. Not because they want to, because the world won't let them not. And that is primarily because, in our day, the state of Israel. The fifth knock, perhaps the most important time. Again, this is so important, so dramatic, we can't take this for granted. Divine providence has surprised our enemies with a sensational discovery that Jewish blood is not free for the taking, it is not hefker. If anti-Semites wish to describe this phenomenon as an eye for an eye, so be it. We will agree with them. I was thinking of this as I was reading an article in, which was it in the Jewish Times? Or wasn't the Jewish Times, but it's been in many other Jewish magazines, about this new movie, Munich. Right? So leave aside the fact that it's apparently historically inaccurate. But the premise of the movie is that somehow there is something immoral about Israel going after the terrorists from Munich, because it's an eye for an eye, and that's an immoral thing, and there's a moral equivalency. This is why the whole Jewish community is a little bit confused, that they should be supportive of this movie, and the God of Doris Spielberg made it. And how could this, I saw somebody write incredulously, how could the same person who makes Schindler's List make this? And people are like, they're confused. No, they're confused. Whatever. Like, well, I don't know anything about it. I just wanted to tell you that I thought of it now, because Rav Soloveitchik's answer is, exactly. En hachanami. You want to tell us we're going an eye for an eye? So be it. And he writes it so dramatically. He says, as you know, I think that everyone who knows me knows that I'm a believer in the Torah Shebaal Peh, in the oral tradition. That's an understatement of the year. His whole life is dedicated to the Torah Shebaal Peh. And we know that Torah Shebaal Peh understands that an eye for an eye, ayin tachas ayin, doesn't mean literally you poke the guy's eye out. It's a monetary thing. However, says Rav Soloveitchik, when it comes to our enemies, I paskin, we should understand the verse literally. We need to fight back, literally, an eye for an eye. He refers to this, and he talks about the secular Jews and the quote-unquote enlightened Jews who think we have to have this higher morality. He says it's a terrible thing. It's based on their own insecurity. They still think that they're Minsk or Brisk of 1905. This nice idyllic existence. They have no idea what they're doing. Vanity of vanities. Revenge is forbidden when it serves no purpose. But if by taking revenge we raise ourselves up to the plane of self-defense, then becomes the elementary right of man qua man to avenge the wrongs inflicted upon him. And finally, the sixth knock, which we must not ignore, was heard when the gates of our land were opened. Jews didn't have a place to go. Kibbutz Goliath, now there's a place for Jews to run. If a particular people expels the Jewish minority from its midst, they can go directly into Zion, and she, like the compassionate mother, will gather in her children. Had the state of Israel arisen before Hitler's Holocaust, hundreds of thousands of Jews might have been saved from the gas chambers of crematoria. The miracle of the state came just a bit late. Whew. At the end here, I have another quote from page 100, where he also again speaks about the beautiful, again, there's so much here, it's so beautiful. Let me just ask you one thing, there's so much here. What's not here? Any allusion to Mashiach, any allusion to... there's not seven knocks. Maybe there are seven or eight, I don't know, he could add. But one knock is for sure not ever mentioned. It's not Mashiach, it is not Geula, and it's certainly not Rav Kook.
Well, it's not put, not only that, but it isn't put in a larger religious framework at all. It's
In and of itself, it has all these wonderful religious things, but it's not part of some other process. That's correct. From 1962 through 67, the Rav delivered keynote addresses at the World Mizrahi Conventions. Those, again, were delivered in Yiddish, and they were eventually published as a book called the Chamesh Drashot, which were then subsequently, in 1973, and 1983, they were translated and published in a book called The Rav Speaks. That book was out of print for years, and just, I think, last year, I have a copy I bought last year. I had xeroxed it from Hawaii Library 10 years ago, because if I was out of print, I'll never get it. But then, they reprinted it, I think, about a year ago, which I own. In fact, to their credit, they kept the exact same page pagination. So some scholar quotes a page, even though it's been reprinted, it's the exact same page. They didn't change a thing. They just reprinted it, which is, I appreciated. So these are five different speeches. Each one of these is so beautiful. It's accessible, easy to read, but so profound. So I took some quotes from the first of these drushas. They don't, even though it says there's 5 years and there's five drushas, although they don't identify each one for the particular year, my guess is that they were arranged chronologically. If that's so, this is an address he gave in 1962. And here you can feel free to look at it inside yourself, but again, relating not just to Hanukkah, as we saw before, but here to the Parshiyos HaShavuot, which we've been reading in Shul the last 2 weeks. He has a very famous, perhaps the most famous part of the book, where he has a drush, which I alluded to, Parshas Mikes 4 years ago, in the sermon when I came to try out for the job of Rabbi of Shomri Amunah. And if you remember, the opening words from that section of my sermon were, over 40 years ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a speech to the Mizrahi. So that's what I was referring to, this speech. He compared the debate between the religious Zionists and non- or anti-Zionists to the debate between Yosef and his brothers. There's a whole beautiful drush about what was going on with Yosef and his brothers, how it was all a misunderstanding. They wanted to keep the traditionalist way of doing things until now, and Yosef saw that there's a new change that's happening, and there's a new economic order, and Yosef wanted to go forward. They were really arguing, Yosef wasn't trying to order, there's all one big misunderstanding. Who was right, said our salvation, between Yosef and the brothers? Look at page 29 here. In this dispute in the name of heaven, divine providence decided in favor of Joseph, and the house of Jacob was saved from destruction only due to Joseph's dreams. Then he applies it. What was the difference, the debate between Joseph of 66-62 and his brethren, the great Torah scholars? And he explained, again, in a similar vein, he suggests that those religious Zionists who wanted to make Aliyah and establish the state of Israel also understood there was a unique opportunity in the world of that day in the aftermath of the Holocaust, etc. And the traditionalists wanted to, no, so to speak, hunker down, wait for Mashiach, we'll do our thing, we'll be hopefully successful at that. And he writes with great respect, and they were great tzaddikim and rishonim. But there was a major debate, again, on Machlokas L'Shem Shemayim, a wonderful debate. So after he analyzes the debate, he says something so powerful, he goes, so who was right? He says on page 32, even though halacha, when we have halachic disputes, we have certain technical legal rules for how to decide such a debate. And historical questions, not those related to legal status of ovens or food, the determination of fixed monetary obligations, but those relating to the destiny of the eternal people, God himself decides as to whose interpretation shall become law, i.e. the historical development. Nor can anyone dispute the ruling of God in this domain. Not only was Yosef proved right, and the controversy between Yosef of yore and his brothers of 1,000 years ago, similarly, God decided in accordance with Joseph's interpretations of the historical process. In our day, the creator of the universe similarly decided that the historical law will be as the Joseph of 5662, i.e. religious Zionist, had predicted. In other words, again, very dramatic drush. If I'm not mistaken, there's one letter in our Shach's collected writings in which he relates to Soloveitchik very critically, and it's because of this drusha. You can imagine the Rav's stature, his speaking abilities, his charisma, and the whole ingenious nature of this drusha. You didn't have to be the Mizrahi convention to have heard about this drusha. This swept across, literally, world Jewry. So part of the world Jewry loved it and was ignited by it, and others were incredibly upset by such a sweeping statement, and I did not have success in locating it. But if I'm not mistaken, again, if you will, the most recent paragon of the other traditionalist view, the non-Zionistic religious view, sort of Shach would be a good embodiment of that. And this was a letter which he just could not stand, which we understand why. Just to mention some of the things that we have after that, I have mentioned, again, we're not going to have time, but just so you should know, Rav Soloveitchik's family, it's a big thing for him. You don't understand Rav Soloveitchik until you realize his family background. His family was rabidly anti-Zionist. Not partially. They were probably the closest thing to the Satmar Rebbe in the non-Hasidic world. I'm not exaggerating. To this day, all of his cousins are still that way. They're not Stam a Gudeniks. They don't take money from the government because they don't want to have anything to do with the state of Israel. The Briskerov, his uncle, was against protesting against the state of Israel. As you people think Haredim are protesting, because it's a protest, you're already acknowledging that this is a state which should allow. He says, if this would happen in Moscow, he said 25 years ago, when all of a sudden the Jews have taken the Red Square to protest, whatever you didn't like. He says, the fact that you think you can protest in Yerushalayim, it's already you're being invited in Sionis. You're already showing that this is a Jewish state where we don't have to worry that they're going to come shoot us. To that extent, he was so rabidly anti. So I have a letter here for you from Reb Chaim. This is going back well over 100 years, where you see the way Reb Chaim, the great-grandfather, views the Tzionists. He writes about them, Rishayim, Gemurim, terrible, evil, Hashmetted them. We know of Soloveitchik's personal and ideological closeness with his grandfather, and therefore you appreciate, which I have in the next source from the Soloveitchik himself, where he speaks about his own metamorphosis, and how he was the star. He wasn't just a member of the Aguda. He was the star of the Aguda before he eventually gave that up and moved over to Mizrahi. And he writes about how difficult and painful that transformation was, but he felt, he looked around, it was in a certain sense, what was for him, true. The next page I have for you, which we're not going to do, next two paragraphs, are a number of scholarly articles that have been written in recent years. One by Mayor Tversky, formerly of Boston, now from Yeshiva University, Soloveitchik's grandson. On the next page, I have two different things from Rabbi Wurzberger, one from an essay, one from his book. I have one from Rabbi Bernard Rosenzweig, who was a prominent Shulrov and head of the RCA for many years, all of which discussing their involvements and their understanding with Soloveitchik as their mentor, and his approach and his dedication to the State of Israel, and specifically each one of them, again and again, hammering home the theme, my grandfather's support for the State of Israel was not messianic. It had nothing to do with Mashiach, nothing to do with Geula. Another embodiment of that I just found, and I want to thank the Kleins, who are apparently Howie and Dvorah Klein, who are listening to the Shurim online, and they're also forwarding it to David Eisen, their son-in-law, in Beit Shemesh, because he's also listening to this. He sent me an email, not only thanking me and enjoying the Shurim, but he sent me additional Maran Mekamos. So I asked him, do you have anything from Avraham Lichtenstein that you know about? Because I know that Lichtenstein in general has the same approach as his father-in-law, but I wanted something in writing. I want something to put on the source book. It's all about the source book. So he sent me something that's brand new. It's an interesting thing. If you want to go to it, it's called tzionut.org. For lack of a better term, I'll call it a left-wing religious Zionist group and website. But again, it's left-wing in the sense that it's not messianic, which, again, in today's day, makes them a minority in that school. It's not a Gush Emunim. It's not a Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. It's not that mentality. And their first newsletter was an interview elected with Rav Lichtenstein. And one of the questions they got right to it, they asked him, "Ma das harav al hamusag me'olamo shel Rav Cook v'talmidav is chalta de geula?" Who? What do you think? Do you agree with Rav Cook and his talmidim is chalta de geula or not? And it's interesting. I wish I had more time, but it's interesting reading. It's beautifully and very difficult to read. You have to be not only a PhD, but you have to be very fluent in the highest form of Israeli language, with all modern Hebrew. And you should just know that two or three of the hardest words are actually English. It took me a while to read this. Zev Friedlander from Tarmit Zion Kol gave me some help with some of the words even. But Lamaisa, or looking at it in English, is not so easy. But he takes a little bit more measured. He basically speaks about the fact that as far as he's concerned, we may very well be in a new stage of history. But as far as he's concerned, two things. Number one is, he feels, and he saw this from Yehuda Cook, for them it's a very physical geula. In other words, it's the land, it's the flowers, it's the tanks, it's the guns. Says Rav Lichtenstein, it's not spiritual enough for me. Whereas for me, geula is not just going to be about rehabilitating the physical land. I want to see more tshuva. I want to see more growth in religiosity. Mashiach goes to usher in a more committed, fully observant Jewish world. And that, or listening, he says, is not happening enough for him to be so, so excited. But he says he still thinks we may very well be. He quotes a Chinese proverb in the third column, right, that to walk a mile first begins with a step. Kam Sini, right, the Chinese proverb. So he says, I don't know if we're on the first step or the 999th. He says we're somewhere in the middle. But the main point, which is what he closes with, which I think is really very true, is that the bottom line is, this is not what I live my life thinking about, and which every day I think I'm going to wake up. He writes at the last line, because it's not like people who are living with geula every moment. And if you've met people like this, living on the Zeitzel and the hilltops, or wherever we're Merkat the Rav, again, we're inspired, at least I am, frankly, very inspired by the Ramuna. But sometimes you're a little bit freaked out. Every moment, it's like, you never know, it's coming tomorrow. I mean, in a certain sense, it's very different, but similar to maybe what the Chavetz Chaim was like. So Lichtenstein says, as far as he's concerned, it could happen. He says, do I deny the fact that Hashem could do anything in this instant? Of course, Hashem could. But if I like looking at things logically through the history and through our sources,
I don't see us at that last stage. It's not something that I'm waiting for and expecting to happen at the last moment. And I conclude by just bringing your attention to the following three sources from Rabbi Lenz. If you followed what we've doing, we're pretty much paralleling Gedolim as we go all the way through history. And I ended off with Rabbi Schubert Spiro. I mentioned that he had had a debate with Rabbi Lenz. So before I get to the debate that Rabbi Lenz had, he has two essays that he writes. Both have been republished in a two-volume book that was published a few years ago called 70 Faces, which is a collection of Rabbi Lamb's significant drushas. On the left-hand side, you have a drusha that Rabbi Lamb gave, which was written up in 1974 in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War. And on the right-hand side, you have a lecture that he gave, which I was actually privileged to hear in person, in December of 1995. Who remembers what that was? The Shloshim of Rabin. In the same book, you have an essay before I had his text of the day, of Rabin's funeral, but then you also have...
1994?
I don't think so.
Yeah, 95.
95.
95.
Okay. I'm just
10 years.
Yeah, just 10 years, exactly. So again, in these two contexts, he mentions in recent years, again, his theme very strong and critical, really, of Gush Emunim, too messianic for him. And then if you turn over, you'll see his very strong debate, which he had. You can put together the fifth page of your source sheet with the tenth page. That last page, this is the debate that he had side by side against Rabbi Schubert Spiro in this Journal of Shema in 1974, where he writes out, of course, he hopes this is a gula, he hopes, maybe it will be, maybe, but as far as he's concerned, it's too risky. We don't put our eggs, so to speak, in that basket. That's not his focus. You can be pro-Israel without being messianist. He writes at one point that this is not messianism, this is messyism. He's very, very dangerous. And again, he's very, very... the debate gets very heated. You can only imagine if we have a Satmar Chassid and Rabbi... This is between Rabbi Lamb and Rabbi Spiro. They're not exactly on the ends of the earth, ideologically. But even on this part of the debate, even in this, if you will, part of the battlefield, the debate is very, very strong. Those who believe in Chassid Gula think that those who don't believe in it are somehow blind to historical realities and don't have faith. And those who do think that they're risking and it's too dangerous and apocalyptic and... Very, very complicated stuff. Again, there's more here than we had a chance to go through, but I hope you'll take the opportunity in a free moment to read this. I think you'll find it very enlightening and very, very enriching. Just to close, I hope that you're more educated about this very, very critical issue than you were 3 weeks ago. Again, from the historical perspective, from the halachic source material, from the hashkafa, I find very often, and as far as I'm concerned, it's at least as much true on both sides of the debate, and if anything, maybe more on the right side of the debate, but really on both sides of the debate, that usually the people who are loudest know the least. And people go around, again, because of who their parents were, or what school they got sent to, or their national origin, they have a certain assumption of what they think is right, but they don't know anything. That's just, unfortunately, the way most people are. And that is certainly not the highest aspirations of a Jew in any area. Certainly one is important for our contemporary life as how we should have, as religious Jews, what should our perspective be. So I hope I've given you opportunity to see not only, if you will, two main schools of thought, but just to make your life more complicated, the realization that in a sophisticated understanding, there are actually a lot more than two schools of thought. There are two poles of thought, but there are many, many nuances in between. And each one of them, Baruch Hashem, over the years, has been espoused and embodied by great Talmidei Chachamim, great Tzaddikim. And there is certainly much to argue for the virtues of virtually every one of the positions. And therefore, those of us, again, we all have to make decisions in our own life. We all have Rabbanim. We all have philosophies that are more in tune with us. But we should be learned and knowledgeable in those. And at the same time, of course, understanding and tolerant of those who don't necessarily take the same perspective as we. Hopefully, they'll show us the same courtesy. Although we all know that doesn't always happen. But as I say, I've met tolerant people from all perspectives, but I've met intolerant people from all perspectives. It's not so much the perspective. It's really more the person. And hopefully, the more we learn, the more we understand. Because the more we know, it's a general rule in life. The more you learn about something, the more complicated you realize it is. I have sometimes, somebody once asked me, Shaila, I didn't know the answer right away. I heard through the grapevine afterwards that they were astounded at my ignorance. It's such a simple Shaila, how could the rabbi not know it? Okay, he didn't realize it was based on Machlokus and the Chavos Das and the Shach, and because he didn't know any of the sources, he thought it was must be a simple Shaila. I happen to have known on that particular question some of the sources. I realized how complicated it was, and therefore I wasn't ready to give an answer. But that's true in microcosm of everything in life. The more we know, the more the complicated it is. It's sometimes easier not to know, but that's not my job. My job is in that sense to make your life harder, because I'm here to educate you so you understand the nuances and the complications, and therefore you'll still come to whatever conclusion you hopefully you'd like, but at least know where it's coming from, appreciate the nuances, appreciate the complication, and hopefully all of us,
Again, with, I hope, no exception, we all hope that we're in a period of history which will be one which culminates in Mashiach's coming, as the grandfather of mine says all the time, you know, it's time for him already, right? It's been a long and hard hindsight. It's been a hard goal. Wouldn't it be nice if this was really it? Halavai, we hope. Shetehei, Rishis Michos Kulasengis. Thank you very much. Yeah.